Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The captain, you know, he went on the radio and he's like, we just want to make sure everyone knows he has a Paralympic champion on the plane.
On the Podium is back with more Olympians and Paralympians sharing their remarkable stories. On the Podium. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 4th of September, these are our main stories. After months of fighting, Ukraine's generals say their troops have breached the first line of Russian defences in the south, near Zaporizhia. More than 20 people have been killed in northeast Syria in clashes between government forces and Turkish-backed rebels. The Israeli government says it's considering deporting rival groups of Eritrean asylum seekers who were involved in clashes in Tel Aviv on Saturday. Also in this podcast,
an event more used to dust storms has been transformed into a muddy quagmire after what's thought to be the longest, heaviest rainfall this festival has seen.
Thousands of people trapped at the Burning Man Festival in Nevada wait for good weather so that the exit roads can reopen. We begin in Ukraine, where the country's generals are reporting significant progress in the counteroffensive against Russia's invasion. They say their troops have breached the first line of Russian defences in the south near Zaporizhia, allowing Ukrainian forces to operate between Moscow's first and second lines. General Oleksandr Tarnavsky, leading the southern counteroffensive, told a British newspaper that Kyiv's army has made an important breakthrough. Ukraine says weeks of overnight work to clear landmines has led to the advance. Paddy O'Connell put the report by the generals to Yuri Sak, an advisor to the Ukrainian Minister of Defence.
This is something which is the result of the smart military planning of our commanders. And General Tarnavsky, who you have just referred to, he's the commander of the southern grouping of the Ukrainian armed forces. And they have been systematically progressing along the front lines. They have been systematically destroying the enemy's ammunition depots, enemy life force, enemy equipment. So, like we said before, even at the time when there was a lot of skepticism about the pace of our offensive operations, we said that, look, we ask for just two things, weapons and patience.
Yes, no,
and
I've heard you ask for them, but I'm needing to tell the listener what's new. Have you broken through the first line of Russian defence, and do you now operate between the first and second line?
Yes, that has been confirmed. So this, you could say to your listeners that this is progress.
I have also read of awful losses. You don't report the death toll. There is difficulty now in finding men to fight. Are you worried that your population is exhausted by war?
Well, the reports, we have seen some of them. They are not accurate. We have no idea what kind of data they're based on. Of course, this is a war, and of course, we do have losses on our side. But at the same time, even during the offensive operations, you know, our losses are considerably smaller than those of the enemy. For example, during the last 24 hours, we have destroyed 600 Russian soldiers and a lot of their equipment, 10 artillery systems, and so on and so forth. So on a daily basis, we inflict more losses on the Russians than we suffer, and we have no problems with the reserves, with the morale of our troops. And we continue to move forward.
That was Yuri Sak, an advisor to the Ukrainian Minister of Defence. Well, for more details on what's going on, I spoke to our correspondent Paul Adams in Kyiv.
So this is an area some distance southeast of Zaporizhia, right on the one of the sort of central areas of the front line that the Ukrainians have been probing and pushing and exploring for some time now. We heard a week or more ago about the fall of a tiny village of Robotyne, with the Ukrainian flag being raised there. And since then, it seems as though Ukrainian forces have been trying to push forward in a couple of directions to try and find gaps in the Russian defences. And we are being told, and we have no way of independently verifying this, but it's coming from a number of sources, that they have indeed made that breakthrough. I think the thing to remember is it's a very small breakthrough on a very small part of a very large front line. What the Ukrainians will try and do now is to widen it in an effort to try and get it big enough so that they can push their armoured infantry through and properly exploit this breakthrough. But that could take some time still, if it happens at all.
Given, though, that they say there has been a breakthrough, albeit relatively small, it seems strange timing for many people that the defence minister, according to President Zelensky, they're going to ask Parliament to dismiss him. What's going on there?
It does seem like strange timing, doesn't it? And this is something that has, in fact, been coming for a little while. There's been quite a bit of chatter about this for some time. It is perhaps part of President Zelensky's wider anti-corruption drive, which has seen a number of high-profile cases throughout this year. There's no suggestion that Mr. Reznikov himself is guilty of any corruption, but there is a feeling, in fact, there have been a number of quite well-publicised cases of corruption when it comes to procurement within his ministry. And that, I think, is why we're hearing President Zelensky saying the time has come to replace him. It is likely that Mr. Reznikov will become the ambassador to the United Kingdom and another politician will take his place as defence minister. Yes, it does seem strange. Mr. Reznikov was a popular figure on the international scene, very much an ambassador for Ukraine, present at all those meetings at which he lobbied hard for Ukraine to receive the kind of equipment that has gradually been handed over. But, you know, after a year and a half of war, Mr. Zelensky has said the time has come to try some new blood.
Paul Adams in Ukraine. Clashes involving Syrian government forces and Turkish-backed fighters in northeast Syria are reported to have left 23 people dead. The fighting happened when SNA fighters tried to move into the Kurdish-held area of Hasaka province. Mike Thompson has more details.
The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says 18 of those who died belonged to a pro-Ankara rebel group known as the Syrian National Army. The other five were reported to be opposing Syrian regime soldiers. The fighting happened when SNA fighters tried to move in to the Kurdish-held area of Hasaka province, near a strip of land by the Turkish border that's controlled by Ankara and its proxies.
Mike Thompson. Next to Israel, and the country's security minister said he plans to propose a bill that would permit the mass arrest and deportation of hundreds of Eritrean migrants. Itamar Ben-Gvir's comments follow violent clashes on the streets of Tel Aviv on Saturday between supporters and opponents of the Eritrean government. Around 160 people were injured as police used tear gas and live rounds to end the clashes. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had this to say.
There remains this serious problem of the illegal infiltrators in southern Tel Aviv, and what happened crossed a red line. This rioting, this bloodshed, this savageness, we cannot accept. We are seeking strong steps against the rioters, including the immediate expulsion of those who took part.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolan Nell, tell me more about how what began as a story about conflict within the Eritrean community could become another battle between the Netanyahu government and those who oppose his reforms.
What's interesting is it's come at a time when Israel is already split over the government's highly controversial judicial overhaul plan, and it has actually fed into that because you've had Mr. Netanyahu and others in his cabinet blaming the Supreme Court for blocking earlier attempts of previous governments to try to push migrants out of Israel. Now, it is very much something that the far-right ministers, particularly the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, has campaigned about. He is now proposing a new basic law on migration, a new quasi-constitutional law, and he wants to use that to try to push ahead with the mass deportation of migrants.
Israel is a signatory to the Refugee Convention, so there would be legal issues there. But do you think this kind of reaction would have been possible under any other government in Israel?
What happened was something unprecedented in Tel Aviv. Some 170 people injured, including a number of police officers, and it's been widely condemned what happened across the political spectrum. So, I mean, certainly it is a pet issue of some of the members of this cabinet. So the response that we're seeing at the moment, for a very hardline response, probably we wouldn't have had them in quite the same way from other governments. But I think we are also on course for another potential point of real tension between the government and the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court finds that efforts by Itamar Ben-Gvir to deport people are against existing basic laws on human dignity and liberty, for example, that could be another real clash ahead.
Leaving the legal matters aside for a second, the Eritreans who are at risk of deportation, and they say if they're deported back to Eritrea, they risk persecution. they're reacting very strongly, aren't they?
Of course, and it's estimated there are about 20,000 asylum seekers from Eritrea and Israel. Most of them have been here for some years, having arrived by crossing Egypt's Sinai Peninsula. They say that they have escaped from one of the world's most repressive countries. And I think you can see now within the community there is this sort of level of shock that has set in. And there was one Eritrean who works at an NGO which helps refugees in Israel, Kibron Tuwende, and this is what he said.
What happened left us shaken. We're ashamed about it, but we're also hurting. We're hurting and we're also afraid, and we feel insecure in this country. Where further can we run to? We ran away from persecution in our country, and the dictator regime continues to persecute us, to silence us.
Kibron Tuwende ending that interview with Yolande Nel. Pope Francis has ended his first papal visit to Mongolia, a country sandwiched between Russia and China. He's long expressed his desire to visit China, but the closest he might get there is Mongolia. At the end of the Mass there, flanked by leading Catholic clerics from Hong Kong, he had this message for China's 12 million Catholics.
These two brother bishops, the Bishop Emeritus of Hong Kong and the current Bishop of Hong Kong, I would like to take advantage of their presence to send a warm greeting to the noble Chinese people. To all the people, I wish the best, and to go forward, always moving forward. And I ask Chinese Catholics to be good Christians and good citizens.
The Pope had arrived in Mongolia on Friday, so what message was he trying to send to Chinese Catholics and the ruling Communist Party? A question for our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Brister.
Well, when the Pope went to Mongolia, many people questioned why. After all, Mongolia's got fewer than 1,500 Catholics. It was suggested that perhaps he was going there to deliver a message, really. His real audience, perhaps, was China, which is next door to Mongolia. I think over the last couple of days, what we've seen is that playing out. So on Saturday, the Pope said, didn't mention China directly, but he said governments have nothing to fear from the Catholic Church. It has no political agenda. Seemed to be directed at Beijing and China. And what he said directly today was about Chinese Catholics. He was saying that they ought to be good Christians, but also importantly, good citizens. Essentially, I think what he was saying to Beijing is, look, you've got nothing to fear from Christians. They can still be loyal to the Communist Party. They can still be good Chinese citizens, as well as being Christians.
And why do you think he needs to say this? Does it go back to a slightly fractious relationship between the Vatican and Beijing?
Pope Francis has put great store by trying to improve relations with China. And the Vatican and Beijing don't have diplomatic relations, but the Pope sees that there are millions of Chinese Catholics, perhaps 12 million, and he wants to help them. So 5 years ago, he did a deal with Beijing so that they'd both agree on the appointment of bishops, because what you have in China, you've got two parallel churches, really, an underground church and an authorised church backed by the Communist Party. The Pope was trying to bring these together, and he thought he could do that by agreeing with the Chinese Communist Party to jointly decide on bishops. China has reneged on that a little bit, appointed a couple of bishops without telling the Vatican. The Vatican seems far more keen on this arrangement than the Chinese government.
And there's never been any suggestion that there's any sedition amongst Catholics in China, is there, at all? So is it just a matter of control, letting Beijing see that it is in charge and in control?
Basically, yes. Chinese leaders are obsessed with control, what their citizens do. And essentially what they don't want is Chinese Catholics to feel allegiance to a foreign religious leader based in Rome, all the way over in Europe. They want their allegiance to be to Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping is more important than God in the eyes of the Chinese Communist Party. And so they're suspicious of any organisation like the Catholic Church, which could influence people's behaviour, which could be an alternative source of power.
Michael Brister. Tens of thousands of people trapped by unseasonal rain and mud at the Burning Man Festival in the American state of Nevada are waiting for a break in the weather so that roads in and out of the desert site can reopen. The burners, as festival goers are known, have been ordered to shelter in place since Saturday after the weather turned the site at Black Rock into a bit of a mud bath. Our correspondent David Willis, who was attending the arts and community event, is one of those stranded.
An event more used to dust storms has been transformed into a muddy quagmire after what's thought to be the longest, heaviest rainfall this festival has seen since it was launched 37 years ago. The day before people were due to start heading home, the desert sand was transformed into thick clay, leaving vehicles bogged down and festival goers squelching their way through ankle-deep mud, prompting the organisers to lock the gates to anyone seeking to enter or leave. They'll remain closed until the ground hardens, allowing the thousands of vehicles stuck here to leave through narrow desert roads without getting bogged down in the mud. Meanwhile, the advice to those stranded remains: conserve food, fuel and water supplies, because you don't know how long you'll be stuck here. The mood remains generally upbeat, but the longer the wait, the more people here will want to see the back of this muddy morass.
David Willis at the Burning Man Festival in Nevada. Still to come.
Generally, most people think of a mullet as short on the side, short on top, long in the back.
And yours is very long on the back. 5 feet 8 inches? It's taller than you, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
A woman from the US state of Tennessee has officially got the longest female mullet in the world.
Unexpected Elements is the podcast exploring the science behind the headlines.
That's an interesting concept.
It's just bubbling with excitement.
Each week, we take a news story you've probably heard of and use the science surrounding it as a springboard to dive into other stories that may not be on your radar.
We're here in my bee lab.
In front of a box of bees.
There were no bad side effects at all.
Unexpected Elements from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. For the first time, Mexico could have two women facing each other in the presidential elections next year. The opposition coalition has formally announced Xochitl Galvez, a politician with indigenous roots who escaped rural poverty, to be their presidential candidate in next year's polls. I heard more from Oscar Lopez, a journalist who covers Mexico for The Washington Post.
Xochitl Galvez is from the state of Hidalgo. She grew up in a small indigenous community. Father was an alcoholic, quite abusive, as she tells it. And she kind of has a bit of a rags to riches story where she ended up going to the National University, studying engineering and founding two quite successful tech companies before going into politics.
So it's very interesting. She came from a very humble and difficult background and made it quite big. She's from the more conservative pan-national Action Party. What kind of a candidate will she be?
Well, she's an interesting case because although, as you say, she does represent the conservative PAN party in parliament, she's actually more progressive herself. And she's said many times that she's not militant for the PAN. And while the PAN is largely anti-abortion, anti-LGBT rights, Xochitl herself is more progressive on those issues. So I think she's trying to build more of a coalition. You know, she is the representative of a kind of fractious opposition coalition of three main parties coming together kind of in opposition to the president and his movement. And so I think she's trying to build kind of a big tent moment, trying to bring in both the conservative base, but also more progressives and also people who are just dissatisfied with the current state of the country.
And her likely opponent, main opponent, is going to be Claudia Sheinbaum from the current president's party.
The polls for the governing party, that's Morena, show that Claudia Sheinbaum is the most likely person to succeed Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who's the current president and can't run for re-election. She's sort of seen as someone who's been sort of handpicked by the president to carry on his legacy and carry on his movement. She's seen as someone very close to the president, someone who can champion his ideals, his vision, but she differs from the president in some significant ways, particularly as someone who is a climate change scientist and seen as someone who could potentially be more environmentally friendly.
Now, how significant is it for Mexican politics and Mexican society that both leading candidates will be women for the first time?
I think it's historic, undeniably. I mean, Mexico is a country where you still see a lot of machismo, very conservative. It has very high rates of violence against women. And historically, you know, women haven't had a significant place in politics. That's changed in recent years as laws were passed to require political parties to have a certain number of women representing them in Congress. And actually, Mexico now has one of the most gender balanced Congresses in the world. But to have a woman running on for both parties as the leading presidential contenders is hugely significant because it means that no matter who wins, Mexico will have a woman president for the first time.
Oscar Lopez from The Washington Post. In August, we reported on a wooden fishing boat that had been found adrift off the Canary Islands with 38 people on board. It had set out from Senegal more than a month earlier, carrying 101 people. Well, the BBC's Joel Gunter now tells the grim story of a tragedy on one of the most dangerous migration routes in the world.
Ademir is sitting indoors with his mother and close family as they share a plate of food. He eats slowly and carefully. His eyes are downcast and his thoughts seem far away. This 21-year-old fisherman has just returned from an unimaginable ordeal. In July, he set out with 101 others from this village in a wooden boat called a pirogue, aiming for the Canary Islands. The boat became hopelessly lost and drifted for more than a month.
We were so tired. We were starving and thirsty and the sun was beating down on us. You cannot do anything, only lie silently, staring at the people who still have some food.
After a week at sea, passengers on the pirogue began to pass away from thirst and hunger. 63 would die under the baking sun, including Adama's brother and his two cousins.
Every time somebody died, I thought I would be next. At first, we said a prayer for each dead person and put their body into the ocean. Later, we just threw the bodies into the water because we didn't even have the energy to pray. We just needed to get rid of the corpses.
Back in the village, after a week with no news, relatives of the migrants began to panic. Adama's mother, Sokna, feared something was terribly wrong.
The whole village was worried, wondering if our family members were lost. Everybody was becoming stressed. I got sick because of the situation and couldn't eat.
In another house nearby, other members of the family are joining to pray. They are in mourning for the three boys who died. Our brother, Adama's cousin, did not make it home.
When we learned that the boat had been found, I thought my brother was coming home. But then they said he was among those who had died in the water. My brother always taught me that if I study hard, I will become successful. When I got married, the first thing he asked me was, "Are you going to finish your studies?" I miss him so much.
Migration experts say that the people leaving these shores are setting out on one of the most dangerous routes in the world. People here in Fastboy will tell you that two of every three boats that leaves is never heard from again. And yet, it is clear that even a tragedy as grave as this one is not going to stop others from taking the same risk.
All along the beach here, fishermen are taking out their wooden boats and bringing home what little catch they have been able to find. They say that industrial overfishing is robbing them of their livelihood. In the shade by a boat, I find Asan, a young fishing captain and his crew, knitting generator covers they can sell to help make ends meet.
I'm thinking about leaving. Right now it is all I'm thinking about. And this tragedy will not stop people here from going. We are trying to find solutions to support our families.
Almost everyone in Fastboy is connected to someone who went on this boat. Back at Adama's home, his mother tells me that the grief here is turning to anger.
All of our hopes have drowned. The people on the boats are the future of Fazboye. They are the hopes of the country. The youth are the seeds of our future, but they are dying.
Senegal, she says, is being robbed of its future.
That report was by Joel Gunter in Senegal. You are listening to the Global News Podcast. A global search has begun for the bass guitar that the English singer and musician Sir Paul McCartney played in his first public performances with the Beatles. He bought the instrument in Hamburg in Germany in 1961 for just $37 or £30, but it later disappeared. Kate Ferrand takes up the story.
Love Me Do, an early track which Sir Paul recorded with his first Hofner guitar. He bought the violin-shaped bass when he was 19 from a shop in Hamburg in 1961. Not yet the focus of screaming fans. It cost just £30. He replaced the instrument 2 years later, but in 1969 it disappeared, seemingly stolen from a storage space. Rumours swirled for years as to its whereabouts. But responding to a personal appeal by the Beatles singer, his long-standing supplier and advisor at Hofner has now launched a full global hunt for the bass. The guitar expert says the £10 million instrument has an importance beyond Sir Paul and Beatles fans.
Kate Ferrand. A woman from Tennessee in the US officially has the longest female mullet in the world. And it's not the mullet fish we're talking about. Tammy Manis, who's 58, is a nurse with an extreme hairstyle, short at the sides and front and 172 centimetres at the back. She'll be featured in next year's Guinness Book of World Records. She's been telling Paul Henley about it, starting with her definition of a mullet.
Well, I've actually went down the rabbit hole and looked, and there were like 19 different types. Generally, most people think of a mullet as short on the side, short on top, long in the back.
And yours is very long on the back. 5 feet 8 inches? It's taller than you, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it is. I had to wet it, stretch it out, and have it measured and validated. And
it sounds sort of inconvenient in daily life terms.
I actually keep it braided during my work week, so it stays braided, so it only comes down to, like, just right around my ankles.
You're a nurse, aren't you?
Yes.
Does it get in the way when you work in hospital?
I work in a health department, so I'm not in a hospital setting, but it's actually not that difficult because since I keep it braided and I've had it for so many years, I know exactly where it's at, and usually I wear a little support belt just because moving around, you know, you don't want to hurt your back, and it kind of keeps it tame, and when I sit down, I just kind of pull it to the front, so it's never really in my way.
What first inspired you to grow your hair this way?
That's the question everyone asks. It was the late 80s. Till Tuesday had a song that came out, Voices Carry, and I love that song, and I looked at it and went, I want one of them there rat tails.
You had a sort of false start, didn't you?
I had kind of a false start. Well, I had that for a few years, and then I cut it off November of 89. I still have the original little rat tail. Immediately regretted that. And so February the 9th, 1990, I went and had shoulder-length hair at the time and cut it and said, leave the tail, and started growing it.
And what kind of reaction do you get daily?
Usually is, wow, that is some long hair. And then it's, is that all yours? Yes. Do you braid that yourself? No. I have a friend that braids it once a week. You know, the usual stuff. How long have you had it? How long does it take to braid it? How do you take care of it?
Presumably, it's not obvious that you've got a mullet from the front.
It's really funny because people don't notice it till I turn around to, like, walk up to the room. They're like, oh, my God, that's yours? Yeah. It's a conversation piece. It's really good. It puts patients at ease. It gives them something to talk about, distracts them if I'm drawing blood.
Tammy Manis with her record-breaking hairstyle. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News Podcast later. Just before we go, though, the Happy Pod this week is asking for your little win, the thing that's happened to you in your life or where you live that's made your week, no matter how small. We've already had emails from listeners in Arizona, Florida and Australia, amongst others. And we'd love to hear your story so we can include it in the podcast this weekend. Drop us an email with your little win to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you'll hear more in the Happy Pod in this feed on Saturday. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email to the same address. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.